Auckland's
Is the sound all good?
Say it again.
Is the sound all good from here?
Yeah, yeah. Mine?
Yeah, all good. Yeah. If you want me to move my microphone closer or further away, let me know.
No, you sound pretty good. Cool. I don't know what the standard is, but
I have no idea. I just have this microphone up here.
Oh, wow, okay.
So I'm just hoping it's good enough.
That's some fancy looking mic.
Thank you, thank you. It's the Shure MV7.
Yeah. Well, I'm really bad with brand names.
This one
is the Samsung Q2U or something like that, and it's always when I search for podcasting mics that are like high quality but not super expensive, this always ends up being the recommendation.
It's a well-known one. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. Cool. So I wanted to ask you this, but where are you actually from? If that's not a secret.
Yeah. So my parents are both Austrian, but I was born in Belgium and raised in Belgium. And then when I was 17, I moved over to the UK to study sports science.
Oh,
indeed. So,
okay. Now I was very tempted to, I was just listening to this, like funny interview thing from some movie, I guess, where the girl is from Australia and the guy said, oh, so like Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's like, no, he is Austrian.
It's always the opposite, right? You know, always. Yeah. It's always, I tell people I'm from Austria, and like, oh, Australia, nice. And I'm like, no, Austria. People always think it's way more exotic than it is.
But okay, so then, sorry, because my mind went wild when you said Austria, but so your parents are from Austria, but you...
Yeah, they moved to Belgium when a couple years before I was born, because my dad got a job with the European Commission. So we had to move to Brussels, and then I was born there, raised there, and then moved to the UK when I was 17. To study sports science.
Oh, okay. And then why did someone say that? And did you go to Wales at any point?
I did not. No, I think it's just the accent. I get, I've got a bit of a Mr. Worldwide thing going on where some people think I'm from America, some people think I'm from Canada, some people think I'm from Turkey, some people think I'm from Italy. Like, no one ever really knows. So my accent throws people for a loop sometimes.
Yeah, because just someone left a comment on when you did the interview with Dave that he's like the Welsh Menno. And I was like, oh, he's Welsh. Because like, I did hear some German type accent type thing in your way of speaking. But I was like, but you are very fluent. So, I mean, you could be Welsh, I guess, for all I know. So
could be anything. You never know. Yeah. Where are you located, by the way?
So I am have been living in North Macedonia for 5 years. I am from Hungary originally. Yeah. So yeah, but I like you, I've been kind of all over the, basically for the last 10 years, I haven't lived in Hungary. So I was in the Netherlands. So I went to uni to the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
I was there for a total of like 3 years. Then I did an internship type thing in New Zealand, was there for like year and a half, and then I ended up here kind of very randomly, almost left after 5 months, but then met my future wife, so got stuck here.
Nice. Yeah. That's not so bad.
Yeah, as some people like to say it in interviews, like my current wife. It's like,
I see.
That's not a very nice thing to say, like my current wife.
It's really not.
Mike, I don't know what's gonna happen next week, but indeed, currently,
hey, someone else comes along.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it gotta be open, right? So how are you doing now with like graduate studies, like PhD and all of that?
Yeah. So I did my undergrad, finished that just over 2 years ago, and now it's been 2 years and like a month since I started my PhD. So currently my third year, and presumably I should be able to finish within the next year. So mm-hmm. Last year of my PhD, only one study left to finish, really, and then just writing up the thesis. So that should be feasible within a year.
Right. And now you have actually published a study, right? Or
Now it's a preprint. It's currently in the publication process. So I've submitted to journals, but it's still being published right now.
Okay. And this is the one on range of motion, right?
You got that. Yep.
Yeah. And is it like public, like the results and stuff like that already?
Yes. Yeah. So everything is public. A big thing we try and focus on is sort of open science, which means A, pre-printing things. So before it even gets published in a journal, having a preprint out there, because it increases exposure and makes it, like, let's say, for example, you submit a journal article to a journal, it can often take 6 to 12 months to get published, which is quite a long time.
Yeah.
So pre-printing it ahead of time helps with that. And in addition, we have the analysis script, the data sheet, all the supplementary materials. We have everything openly available, which means theoretically, if someone has some knowledge in R, the software used, they could literally just download everything, run the analyses, and check whether or not we perform them correctly and whether or not the results we reported are actually the ones that are supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's all available online and it's all free as well. So you don't have to have institutional login or use Sci-Hub, what have you. You can just download it yourself.
Right, right. No, that's awesome. And so you are obviously now very much into the range of motion topic. Was that in some part at least influenced by your time at RP, or I don't know if you still have any like collaboration with them?
Yeah, absolutely. So just before I started my PhD, I'd been doing some work for RP. Like, I wasn't an intern with them or anything yet, but I was doing some random work, like the timestamps on YouTube, and so forth. And I went to the seminar in London in 2019. And in general, just as a result of being into hypertrophy training, into RP and that sort of stuff at the time, my interest with range of motion grew and I sort of read around it a little bit. And yeah, so when I was thinking about what to do after my undergrad, I was like, huh, range of motion is pretty interesting. Let me apply for a PhD and have my research proposal center around range of motion. Because at the time, there wasn't that much evidence yet. And so I thought it was worth getting into. But yeah, I'd say it's funny you should ask that. I'd say before I started the PhD, my views on range of motion and my expectation of the results I would come across during my PhD were quite different from what ended up happening. So yeah, it's been an interesting experience.
Yeah. Do you now that you have been studying this, you look at like a lot of the things that are put out by others and the smart things they are, like the sciencey things they are saying about, like, so if you do this with your range of motion, like if you bend, like, I don't know, like the bicep curl is an easy example just because I see that so much on my Instagram feed, but like, yeah, so if you do this, so you lift the bar and you do a bit of a shoulder flexion at the end, obviously like the Israel/hole curl, that's one example, but there are tons of other things like that from other people as well. So you look at things like that, and now you look at those differently than you did before?
100%. I think before I started my PhD, I was very much on board with, for example, getting some shoulder flexion at the top of a curl to increase range of motion at short muscle lengths, so get more repeat contraction, essentially. Whereas nowadays, for example, on curls, I'm not so bothered about getting a lot of shoulder flexion involved, because that's essentially increasing the range of motion, but at short muscle lengths. And based on the results we have now and based on a lot of different studies, I don't think increasing range of motion at short muscle lengths is necessarily a good thing for hypertrophy. You know, like, let's say you're doing a pretty full range of motion already, but you're just missing out on some range of motion in the short range. Like, you think about a machine chest fly where you get to just, you know, here versus a crossover where you get all the way here.
Yeah.
Technically, with a chest fly, you're missing out on some quote-unquote range of motion, but it is at short muscle lengths. But I don't think that for hypertrophy, you're missing out on anything there, because long muscle lengths appear to be quite important for hypertrophy.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think, like, when you're seeing the discussions about this out there, like, to me, it's always really amazing how quickly something can become a fad, and there are better and worse fads. So like, there are some things that became a fad, but they were still useful on the net balance. But do you already see some like fadization of this range of like a long muscle length stuff a little bit in the industry?
Absolutely. At the same time, I think it's not a fad I'm too opposed to. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is there's a decent amount of evidence in favor of it, right? So it's not as though there's like two studies with small sample sizes that say, hey, this is the case. It's more like we have around 8 studies comparing partial to full range of motion, 6 studies comparing partial ranges of motion at different muscle lengths, some isometric data. Like, there's quite a few studies overall already. So that's why I'm not too concerned about it becoming a fad based on no evidence. At least there is some evidence for its use. And the second thing is, like, your training anyways, range of motion is one of those things where whether you use one range of motion or the other, there's no real cost to you, you know? Okay. Like, you're not spending more time training. You're not really, probably at least, risking injury more or anything like that. So at the very least, you're getting the same results, right? I think it's important to keep in mind that we're not talking about huge effects here. So whether you're using, you know, the optimal TM range of motion for hypertrophy at long muscle lengths and so forth, or using just a normal range of motion, the effect, the difference between the two for hypertrophy isn't going to be that huge. But at the same time, because the cost of implementing one versus the other is essentially non-existent, I'm not too concerned about it becoming a fad. I just think people need to keep in mind we're talking about small effects too. You know?
Yeah. It's so okay. Maybe let's start at the beginning, because now we're kind of getting into it, sort of, but not really. So yeah, like before this has become like more so just out there in the industry, I think my stance on this was just kind of following other people, like getting into the science a little bit, but not like to the depth that you are now. So I would have said full range of motion is superior. Yeah, the stretch is important, but it's good to train like the full contractile range. And if there is a muscle where it would be difficult to do that at the same time with one movement, then pick movements that do both. But partial range of motion is pretty demonstrably worse. And there was this one study that kept being referenced where I think it was the bench press. So like they did like, I think the bottom part, like half, top half, but they equated the volume with just the full range of motion bench press. And still with that, the full range of motion was found to be more effective. So I said things like this, but, you know, bottom line, full range of motion is better. So as opposed to that, it seems like, please take it away.
Yeah. So as opposed to that, for hypertrophy, it seems like full range of motion is likely only better than a partial range of motion if and when it includes lower muscle lengths, right?
Mm-hmm.
So think about it this way. A full range of motion chest fly is only better than a partial range of motion chest fly if you're missing out on getting a deep stretch on your chest at the bottom, right?
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you are getting some range of motion at long muscle lengths, like for example, the bottom of a bicep curl, it's not clear that getting the top part of that range of motion is going to add much, if anything, to your hypertrophy results. It might even be slightly worse because you're proportionately spending more time at short muscle lengths, which don't seem to be as productive for hypertrophy as long muscle lengths.
Yeah.
Whereas if you, for example, just did partials at lower muscle lengths, you then spend essentially the whole set at those most productive muscle lengths. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so nowadays for hypertrophy, I'd say as long as you're including and probably biasing towards lower muscle lengths, so for example, the bottom of a bicep curl, the bottom of a chest fly, the bottom of a squat, as long as you're including those and potentially emphasizing those, I think for hypertrophy, you're doing your best job. For strength, it's a bit more nuanced. Specificity likely is pretty important. So that also applies to performance outcomes generally. So if you want to get better at sprinting, for example, deep squats might not be the best exercise all the time. They might be helpful for getting hypertrophy. As I mentioned, lower muscle length is pretty important for hypertrophy. But for specificity reasons, for performance, you probably do want to train in the range of motion you care about getting stronger, faster, better in. And then for certain sports like powerlifting, for example, where muscle mass probably does play a pretty big role in how strong you get long-term, in the off-season, you might want to incorporate some lower muscle length work too.
Right. What did I want to say? This is why I should take notes while I'm speaking with someone. Four things popped into my head. One is to ask you about like old school, like, how did, like, it always makes me think whenever I hear something like that, I try to think of how, like, does this help explaining certain things that we are seeing in the real world? And one of my pet peeves have been for a while now is that we try to be very sophisticated now with exercise selection and execution and everything. yet we look at those guys like Arnold and even guys before that. And I mean, we can see that it's not like they were doing any worse than us, at least like drug dosage equated. And I mean, if you look at their movements, a lot of it was actually free weight stuff. And with those ones, maybe like an exception would be curls, but you really, you're hitting the muscles at long muscle lengths for the most part. Right. So 100%. Yeah. You have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely do. So I think you very much hit it on the head when you say, oh, sometimes with new evidence, I want to see whether or not that confirms some of the more anecdotal things I've been seeing. And I think it does in this case, in several ways. The way in which it does, the first one, would be when you look at bodybuilders, they often advise a variety of things, right? Like some bodybuilders are about high-intensity training versus higher volume training. And the same applies to range of motion. And with range of motion, as I mentioned earlier, the effect size differences we're talking about here are really not that big. Mm-hmm. So the person advocating for partial reps in the shortened position probably still saw pretty good growth. The person advocating for full range of motion or pretty full range of motion or active range of motion probably also saw pretty good growth. Now, does that mean all approaches are equivalent, you know, just as good as the next approach? No. But it does mean that, you know, people got jacked by and large almost irrespective of the range of motion they used, because it plays a relatively small role compared to genetics, PEDs, training as a whole, for example, because range of motion is like a very much a sub-variable within the training equation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another thing you can say, though, is that generally speaking, it seems like bodybuilders kind of gravitated, at least as a population, I would say, towards the concept of active range of motion, right?
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean getting the deepest stretch of all time. Like, it doesn't mean using a six-plate deficit on RDLs to get as deep of a stretch as possible. But it does mean generally getting a reasonably good stretch and not spending too much time at lockout, for example. And that very much mirrors what the studies that have been conducted so far did, right? Like, very few of the studies had people train to extremely long muscle lengths. Most of the time, it was like the deepest squat condition would have been like slightly below parallel, maybe a bit more than that. But most of the time, it was more like, oh, let's have people squat two parallel versus squat just a half squat. And generally, at least somewhat longer muscle lengths, not the most maximally long muscle lengths, were beneficial for hypertrophy. And so when you think about what active range of motion is, it is essentially just getting a reasonably long muscle length, right? Like, you didn't really see bodybuilders back in the day go to a six-plate RDL with a deficit. They mostly just did, you know, RDLs to the floor, but usually went pretty close to the floor and got a decent stretch. And it's possible that with all this longer muscle length training stuff, you don't really need to maximize muscle length. So you don't need to reach for the longest muscle lengths possible. But you do potentially, or at least very probably, want to reach for long enough muscle lengths. Now, if I had to make recommendations, would I say just reach reasonably long muscle lengths, or would I say reach the longest muscle lengths you reasonably can? I would say the latter, and that's just because I think the principle so far of longer muscle lengths are better for hypertrophy has held up very consistently, right?
Yeah.
And so if I had to make one recommendation that's simple, it's go as deep as you comfortably can, and that's it.
Right. So maybe a bit premature to talk about this, but I want to tie it together with something. But I'm assuming that you have experimented with this now quite a lot. And what have you found with yourself? I can tell you, for example, that maybe you have seen these posts as well, like the biceps and the triceps don't benefit from big stretch as well. And it's like, I don't know. But my first thought was like, I would not be shocked if one day that turned out to be somewhat correct, at least, because like, I never felt like anytime I tried to stretch the biceps out, it just feels awkward as hell. At least if I try to do it with like with a preacher curl with an easy bar or something, like with a supinated grip. Like, holy shit. Like, I just feel it, like the elbow crease. Like, I just felt this really awkward thing. Like, I don't know what, but something is going to tear over there. Whereas like, if I think of my chest, for example, like a big stretch on the chest is like just so intuitive, so natural, just so right. Right. Like, it just feels so appropriate. Like, you immediately feel that what is working here and what is being stretched out is exactly what should be stretched out. And so also with the hamstrings, like you do an RDL, like, yes, like that's exactly what I'm supposed to be feeling there. So I was like, I would not be shocked if like the biceps are just really not meant to be trained that way. Cause it's just, it seems like it's just not natural. I don't know. But what have you found?
Yeah, 100%. So I think what you're describing mostly comes down to what you've been experiencing so far with most exercises, right? Like think about most bicep training. Most bicep training, at least with free weights, A, you don't positionally get a deep stretch on your bicep. Like your shoulder is really hyperextended and your elbow fully extended. And that only happens if you're trying to make it that way. For example, a Bayesian curl or like a behind the back cable curl. That's the one exercise where you get both a positional stretch, like as in your biceps is anatomically lengthened, and you also have a decent amount of tension in that position. Whereas when you're doing like standing dumbbell curls, there's essentially no tension. Your bicep don't have to produce much tension to lift the load at the bottom. And it's not that lengthened. It's literally at resting muscle length, because that's when you walk around, the quote-unquote default position is exactly that position, right? Like you're not walking around like this. You're walking around with your arms straight. So it's not that much of a stretch. Whereas with chest and hamstrings, for example, as you described, most exercises you do for those muscle groups involve a decent stretch. Like a bench press, you do get a decent stretch on your chest. It's not crazy, not like a machine fly, but you do get some stretch. So I think when you're talking about comfort during training a certain muscle group, I think it is probably mostly related to just being used to it. Like when I first started doing easy bar preach curls recently again, and I was doing like partials and length and range, I was like, holy shit, you know, this is a lot of tension at low muscle lengths, you know? So I think that is mostly it. In my own personal training, to be honest, what I've seen generally is that I think certain muscle groups respond slightly better to emphasizing longer muscle lengths than others. So, for example, certain body parts can really only be trained with exercises that are easy at longer muscle lengths and harder at shorter muscle lengths. So when you think about the back or the side delts or the biceps, as we just mentioned, almost all the exercises you can do for those muscle groups are very difficult near the quote-unquote peak contraction and quite easy at the sort of full stretch position. So a cable row, for example, at the fully stressed out position, it's very easy to get some half reps, right? Like you'd use a lot of weight for that. On the other hand, getting full range of motion reps on a cable row and touching your chest on every rep, you really can't use that much weight because the fully contracted position is quite weak, quote unquote, or it's quite difficult to do that with a lot of weight. And so for those muscle groups, I think emphasizing the stretched out position can be helpful. And you can do that in a variety of ways. One would be doing partials at lower muscle lengths so that you can actually stimulate that range of motion a bit more effectively. Another one would be pausing in that position so that you proportionately spend more time in that position than you would otherwise during a set. Another one would be certain machines, like for example, prime back rows, prime row machines, I guess, or prime chest presses, where you can preferentially load a certain aspect of the range of motion, whether that's the start of the range of motion or the end, and just making sure that most of the load comes from that lengthened position. And in general, certain exercises you can pick that are better than others. So example, a dumbbell lateral raise, all else being equal, probably worse than a cable lateral raise, because a cable lateral raise allows you to get both a deeper stretch in terms of positioning, right? Like you can actually go further than just the midline or your arm being straight at the bottom. You can go further than that and get more of a stretch. And also there will actually be tension or a reasonable degree of tension at the bottom, which you wouldn't get during a dumbbell lateral raise. And yeah, you could sometimes with logistical constraints, like let's say you're training at home, you don't have cables. You can make up for some of those things by, for example, doing partials at lower muscle lengths with dumbbells so that you essentially just make up for the easier range of motion, that being the bottom part, by just using more weight to counteract it and thus making it effective. And that can be one way to overcome logistical constraints, like not having certain machines or what have you, when you still want to emphasize lower muscle lengths for hypertrophy.
And you have because I'm not sure, like I have seen this or I have seen at least like screenshots of this publication, this preprint thing that is already out there. But please excuse me that I'm forgetting it. But have you already looked at like how different muscles react to this?
So we've looked at that in two ways. The first way was we basically grouped all the outcomes. So that was hypertrophy, strength, power, everything, and divided them into upper and lower body and compared partial range of motion versus full range of motion. And it doesn't seem on the whole like the upper and lower body respond differently when everything is combined, right?
Yeah.
Now, I'm assuming your question is mostly about hypertrophy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
In that case, what I can tell you, and that's from me reading all of the studies individually, it doesn't seem clear to me that the upper and lower body would necessarily respond differently. So, for example, people have been making claims about the biceps and triceps not responding to stretch-mediated hypertrophy, right?
Yeah.
That is not supported by the most direct evidence we have. So we now have three studies comparing the same range of motion, so a partial range of motion, at different muscle lengths. So specifically, they were doing, for example, I'm sure you've seen the push-down versus overhead extension study.
Yeah, yeah.
There's been two of those, pretty similar designs, and one with the bicep as well. And long story short, in two of those three studies, one in the biceps and one in the triceps, they saw better hypertrophy when doing the same range of motion, but at lower muscle lengths. And then one study found no difference, but you got to keep in mind that that is one study out of a lot of studies on muscle length for hypertrophy. So with that many studies in a body of evidence, you would expect some results to be like really positive effects. Like let's say there's a true effect, it's small, but it's positive.
Yeah.
Because that's the case, if you don't have huge sample size for your study, you'd expect to see some studies that have a really large positive effect and some studies that find no difference or even slight negative effects, right? Because there's a normal distribution around the true effect, quote unquote. And generally, with lower sample size especially, you'll find a variety of outcomes across different studies.
It's it wouldn't make sense why that would be the case with just like two muscle groups, and it's not the case with most of the other ones. Like I said, the only thing that I did think of is like, well, I mean, it just seems like such a pain in the ass to actually train them at long muscle length. Although I will say that oftentimes, and that's kind of an unfortunate thing. Maybe you have some thoughts on that too. Like something can feel uncomfortable because of like connective tissue reasons, not because the muscle couldn't benefit from it. So, I mean, it could be that like a preacher curl with like a fairly flexed shoulder, like close to like horizontal, would be perfect for the biceps, but like it's simply that you're like the elbow tendon, like some tendons of the bicep, like just cannot tolerate it. So I mean, what is it? Is it that the bicep cannot benefit from it, or it's just like, well, it's unfortunate that your connective tissue is not robust enough?
100%.
Yeah,
and I think that's where a lot of practical application comes in. In practice, you're dealing with individuals, right? Individuals have all sorts of constraints, like injury, like preference, like buy into certain methods. Like I'm sure you've had clients who come in, come for you to coach for coaching, and they have buy-in to certain methods previously. Like let's say, for example, they were big fans of Dorian Yates, right?
Yeah.
And even though you might have prescribed them higher set numbers initially, right? You might back off that a little bit to sort of give them time to acclimate, or maybe, you know, work with what you got, right? You don't want to shock them and put them something else and lose the buy-in that they have into you as a coach. So you gradually move them across as they are more willing and more, just more willing to switch methods, I suppose. Yeah. And the same applies to training at lower muscle lengths, especially for certain muscle groups, right? Like I haven't really met anyone who, first time I speak to them, they're like, yeah, I train my side delts at super long muscle lengths because it's important for hypertrophy. No, I have to sort of like sell them the idea over time. Like initially I'm like, okay, let's do this on quads and hamstrings, which they're probably used to. And then gradually I explain sort of the rationale behind certain exercises to them that, hey, lower muscle lengths, pretty important. And then I can gradually expose them to the idea that that also applies to your side delts and to your bicep and tricep as well, as we just discussed.
Yeah.
And generally move them over there. I do think with range of motion and long muscle lengths, as it relates to discomfort or pain and injury, there is something to be said for, quote unquote, the active range of motion. And what I mean by that is, generally in the evidence, with people with pre-existing injuries, one finding you do tend to see, to my understanding at least, is that when people train a muscle group at the extremes of range of motion, for example, a deep, deep stretch or like a complete peak contraction, if they already have pre-existing pain, like a pre-existing injury, generally that will exacerbate the pain they experience.
Mm.
And so if, for example, you have an injury and it doesn't feel comfortable or it makes the pain worse when you go and get a deep stretch on your bicep, then yeah, I would say for the time being, avoid it and then gradually work towards it as pain allows. But there is some truth to that, that if you have some sort of pre-existing injury or condition, I would say gradually incorporate it as you grow accustomed to it and pain doesn't prevent you from doing so.
Yeah. That's very useful. And what you just said there about, the active range of motion, how much do you buy into that in general? Like, I even remember being, having seen a debate between Mike Israetel and Nick
Tuminello, I think
that him. Yeah. How do you say his name?
Tuminello, I think.
Tuminello. Yeah, that sounds good to me.
I'm sure you're used to people mispronouncing your name, so I assume you have empathy for him.
Yeah. Although, like, I think it's just the C and the S after that. It just doesn't make sense because it's only in Hungarian that's a ch. Like, in other, it's like, it makes total sense that's how they would say it. So they were talking about this whole active range of motion versus, like, total range of motion thing. And... yeah, Mike Israetel was a bit skeptical about it. And I mean, to be fair, it's tough to tell, right? Like with when it's over, when a muscle is overstretched, that's passive insufficiency, right?
Correct. Yeah.
So with the other one, so active insufficiency, but it's overly shortened, that's a bit more easy to tell, right? Because it cramps up, right? So try sitting on your heels with a completely straight torso, like you will feel your hamstring cramping up like crazy. Whereas like overstretching it, you don't really feel the point at which it's overstretched. So like it could be that, okay, so like if I bend my arm, my tricep is now lengthened. If I raise my arm, it's also lengthened. So it could be that at this point it's overstretched.
Sure.
But I don't feel the difference. Like I feel zero difference in my tricep. Absolutely. So like, what are your thoughts on this
whole I've got active... several thoughts here. The first one is regarding the direct evidence we have here. So there's two studies comparing regular training with regular machines, right? Like think about the machines you have at your gym. They're not particularly designed to match the strength curve, or aka how much tension you can produce at different muscle lengths, to the resistance curve, versus two programs using the same sets, reps, et cetera, but using machines that were designed to match those curves together. So presumably, if, for example, you weren't able to produce much tension at low muscle lengths, you would then be able to. Long story short, in neither of those two studies did they find better hypertrophy in the group using those specially engineered or designed machines. So at the very least, the notion that you always need to perfectly match the strength curve of the individual to the difficulty or resistance curve of a machine or an exercise, probably not true, right? You have some wiggle room. With regards to getting into passive insufficiency and getting to such long muscle lengths that your muscle is no longer able to produce much tension and thus making the exercise worse as a whole, there's a few things here. Generally, first of all, I don't think that'll almost ever happen with a person. Like mobility, I think, is much more of a bottleneck on range of motion and on the ability of a muscle to produce tension before passive insufficiency ever becomes an issue, really. Another thing you have to keep in mind is if you were really getting into passive insufficiency, you would usually be able to tell quite clearly, right? Like the load you would have to use would drop off substantially. Because if you're getting to super, super long muscle lengths to the point where your muscle is no longer able to produce a lot of force, that would then, by extension, mean that A, you would use a lot less weight as a result because you just can't lift the same weight anymore because you're not as strong in that position. And that would then become more of a bottleneck to completing the repetition, right? Like you would gradually fail reps more and more here instead of like up here. Make sense?
Yeah.
And secondly, you would notice a big drop off in weight, basically. And generally speaking with clients, I've never really, and with myself as well, within the constraints of mobility, I've never really noticed someone who had a huge drop off in weight used with a pretty long range of motion up to like, you know, squat depth of this much versus squat depth of this much. Usually it's pretty proportional to the amount of range of motion being added. With the exception being if someone's, for example, never squatted ass to grass, Yeah, in that case, it might just be a specificity of range of motion for strength thing, more so than a, oh, your quads are now so lengthened that you're in passive insufficiency and unable to produce more tension to lift the weight. So I think generally, it honestly doesn't really happen, practically speaking. And I think that is a point that is very strongly bolstered by the evidence we have on partial range of motion versus full range of motion in the evidence. So as I said earlier, generally, the depth, for example, to which participants squatted in these studies is pretty low, but not crazy low. Like, for example, below parallel, but not like ass to ass, like crazy. And at least to that point, you don't hit anything like passive insufficiency and you see better hypertrophy. Yeah. And so I think at the very least, for almost everyone, training as quote unquote deep as they can go, like the longest muscle length they can reach, is a good thing. And for some freaky individuals out there, that might mean they actually reach passive insufficiency. But I'm be honest, I've never seen someone reach that point. But if they did, you would very clearly be able to tell by the weight they would be lifting. And in general, because the evidence as a whole just really supports lower muscle lengths, it's kind of like it's a theoretical concern that I don't see popping up basically almost ever in the real world. And we have so much evidence for a much stronger point that I'm not really too concerned with that potential issue that might arise with too long a muscle length.
Yeah, I might actually be one of those people, at least with some, like, I don't know, but like, I just know that when I do this, like a lot of people give me strange looks. So apparently this is more flexible than most people. Mm-hmm. So it could be that with some joints, at least I could be, but to be honest, the only example I can think of is actually the stiff-legged deadlift with a completely straight knee. Like on that one, there's just something very awkward about that feeling, that especially like it's actually similar to the bicep, like kind of the back of the knee. But I would not be surprised if the hamstring was actually slightly overstretched. I don't know. It indeed is probably not going to be the main bottleneck for a lot of people, because if they simply don't allow their lower back to round, I would guess that most people would stop before that point.
Exactly. So, exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think even with the RDL, I mean, most people like myself, RDL with slightly bent knee, which I'm not sure makes much sense necessarily. It's just like a thing I got used to. But I haven't really seen many people be able to RDL way less with like slightly more extended knees versus slightly more bent knees.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a possibility. And I do think that hamstrings are potentially one of the muscle groups where I can see that happening a bit more, practically speaking. Whereas like for biceps, triceps, chest, I haven't really ever met anyone who had a similar concern or a similar issue where they just get so deep of a stretch that the weight they use is meaningfully lower.
Yeah. So when it comes to this whole concept in general, does a part of you think like, man, like it's very interesting, but surely it must be wrong, at least in some sense, that like the whole contracted like range of an exercise or a muscle is just kind of like almost useless. Like it's not useless, because again, like you said it, like you could just train that part and you would get some growth. But like it would just make so much sense, like, yeah, with a bicep, like surely, like you look at Arnold's arm when he's like contracting all the way here, like some big things are happening there in that bicep. Like you can see it, like surely it's not by accident, like you need to train that as well. Like, do you have that to some extent?
Yeah. So there is some evidence, or at least a rationale for why a full range of motion, or at least including some shorter muscle length work in your program, makes sense. And that mostly boils down to regional activation and hypertrophy. So one of the big rationales for why people used to tout, and probably still do tout, for full range of motion is regional activation, which means both between muscle groups, like for example, the bottom of a row might target different muscle groups in your back than the top of a row, right?
Mm-hmm.
But also within muscle groups, like for example, the bottom of a row might target and stimulate hypertrophy in slightly different areas or fibers of your rhomboids than the top of a row. And so if you want to get even hypertrophy across the whole muscle, and usually that also means if you get even hypertrophy instead of just hypertrophy in one area, greater hypertrophy as a whole, right?
Yeah.
Then you would want to use a full range of motion, or at least train the rhomboids at a variety of muscle lengths in your training program as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And that's honestly, intuitively, makes a ton of sense, right? The issue with that, and so we are currently writing a Strong by Science article on range of motion, muscle length, and everything. It's pretty much finished now, and it's going to be published on the 1st of November. But in that article, we go into a ton of depth about basically everything, and Greg Knuckles put a lot of good stuff into this as well. One of the things we looked at, and I also looked at as part of my meta-analysis, was looking at each study individually as far as regional hypertrophy went. So not all studies look at regional hypertrophy, right? Like a lot of studies just look at whole muscle hypertrophy as a whole, right? Like they don't look at different sites. Yeah. But some studies using, for example, the ultrasound, which I'm currently using for my PhD as well, do separate between different sites of a muscle, so different areas. Usually with differentiations made between more proximal areas, so closer to the origin point of a muscle, and that's generally closer to the midpoint of the body. So for example, for the calves, that would be the knee is the origin point. And then more distal points would be closer to the insertion point, like, for example, the ankle for the calf. And generally, when you look at regional hypertrophy when training at shorter muscle lengths versus longer muscle lengths and so forth, what you see is that short muscle length training does pretty well at stimulating proximal areas of a muscle group. So, for example, the calf, that would be closer to the knee. But it doesn't do as well as longer muscle length work for more distal areas, like, for example, closer to the ankle for the calves. On the other hand, it seems like both full range of motion and long muscle length partials do a pretty good job of stimulating hypertrophy all across the muscle group, so both at proximal areas and also more distal areas. So it's possible that the difference in overall hypertrophy we see between short muscle length work and long muscle length work stems from the difference in hypertrophy at distal sites. So there's the same hypertrophy at more proximal sites, like closer to the knee for the calves. But when you're doing shorter muscle length work, you just don't get as much hypertrophy at the near the ankle as you would if you did longer muscle length work. And that might help explain the difference in overall hypertrophy between shorter muscle length work and longer muscle length work.
Okay. So then in the case of the biceps, for example, if someone is doing like concentration curls only, like basically no stretch at the bottom, then they would get more growth like here?
No. So shoulder. So shoulder is the origin point or close to the shoulder. And then the elbow.
Oh, okay. Then, yeah. Sorry. I was like, okay. So calves, ankles. Yeah. It was
indeed.
Like...
Yeah. A lot of words.
Yeah. I was trying to convert. Like there should be a converter, like an online calculator.
Yeah. Calculator. Yeah.
yeah. You know, you're a nerd if you laugh at this.
Indeed.
So, what was I going to say? Yeah. Do you think, like, I'm sure you have thought about it, like if we actually implemented this from now on and a lot more of us, which we probably will, is this going to change some of the general recommendations for like training volume and things like that?
Yeah. So there is one possibility, and that is that longer muscle length training is generally more fatiguing by some amount than shorter muscle length training. And so all else being equal, if you start emphasizing longer muscle length training more, whether that be by pausing at the fully stretched position or by incorporating some long muscle length partials or any other way to emphasize longer muscle lengths, that your overall training volume might need to decrease slightly. My hunch is that overall, the gain in stimulus you see by training at lower muscle lengths is still worth it compared to how much fatigue you gain. Like you proportionally gain more stimulus compared to the fatigue you accrue as a trade-off.
Yeah.
But it is possible that overall your training volume might have to decrease. I think that is a possibility. Like it's a possibility that longer muscle length work is more fatiguing. Part of me thinks that in the research we have, it is mostly as a consequence of novelty. So generally, when you first incorporate a new training method or a new training stimulus in general, you will see greater muscle damage and soreness following that incorporation of something new. But then as you repeat that stimulus over time, the response you see decreases. So first time you train legs, for example, in your life, you're going to get sore, whatever you do, you know? But then the second time you do the exact same session, for example, you'll get meaningfully less sore until maybe 10, 15 sessions in, you may not even get sore at all anymore. And so I think part of the increased fatigue following longer muscle length work compared to shorter muscle length work is a result of novelty. And I'm not super sure whether or not lower muscle length work is inherently more fatiguing if novelty were accounted for, if that makes sense.
And of course, probably I'm not the only person who had this thought of, I mean, even with Dave McConey, you talked about Cavs, right? Like, again, trying to explain what happens in real life with anything new that we learn. It's always interesting. And yeah, so like if you think about the stubborn muscle groups, the Cavs are definitely one, but that's kind of a unique one again, because like we are always using it and like there's some stretch on those calves and contraction as well as we are walking. But side delts, for example, or like that one is like, even if you do the most hardcore, like behind the back cable lateral raise or something, it's still not going to be anything close to like a big pec stretch. Right. So do you think, like, just theorizing over it, that like the stubbornness of a muscle group is related to the stretch that it can be put under?
Yeah, to an extent. I think with a lot of stubborn muscle groups, it is just straight up genetics. But I think to an extent that may play a role, where at least for most people, the exercises they think about when trying to train a muscle group and the way they perform it might not be putting much of a stretch on the muscle. Whereas for others, for example, let's say the hamstrings or the glutes are really easy to target directly, because almost every glute exercise you can think of places, except for maybe the hip thrust to an extent, places a meaningful amount of tension and difficulty on the glutes at the bottom or at the stretch position. So it's really easy to train, right? Like you just do some deadlifts or some squats or some lunges, and they all put a ton of tension on the glutes in length position. Whereas for other muscle groups, you may have a bit of a harder time to milk out that long muscle length work, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because, I mean, if I'm just thinking anecdotally, for me, like my best body part or most gifted one would be my chest, but it's kind of stupid, because even those that have terrible chest and let's say good shoulders, like even they will get a bigger stretch, I guess, on their pecs than they do on their shoulders. Yeah. But if we're talking about muscle groups, the only exception I can think of to a lot of these, but basically a lot of the examples that we brought up here, like chest, yes, like that can be stretched out really nicely. Biceps, kind of awkward. And some muscle groups are just hard to stretch out. The back in general, it's kind of an odd one for me, because if you're creative with your training and like you do some of these like sophisticated pull down variations and everything, it can actually be put into some really nicely lengthened positions. But I mean, not that many people have done that historically. Like, yeah, Dorian did pullovers, and he even did some like narrow like pull downs with the chest support, which I don't even know where the hell did he get that machine back then. But and I still don't have one in my gym. God damn it, it's crazy. And then, yeah, like, so basically they do dumbbell rows and wide pull downs. Like that's what like tons and tons of bodybuilders did. And the back is not exactly like a historically stubborn muscle group for most lifters. So it's kind of a weird one, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree. I would say this kind of, and I would take this with a huge grain of salt, but this kind of adds credibility to the idea that you might not need to train at the very longest muscle length possible. A long enough muscle length might do the trick. And you might not need to, for example, as I mentioned earlier, there isn't a ton of evidence, or actually really any evidence, in support of matching strength curve to resistance curve. And likewise, there might not be a ton of support for the idea that you need to make the lengthened position the hardest position. So it might just be that making it reasonably hard, or at least having a decent amount of tension, that is sufficient. So during back training, for example, yeah, sure, the lengthened position is pretty much never where you're going to fail a full range of motion rep.
Yeah.
There might just be enough tension for you to get pretty good results out of most back exercises just as they are, right?
Yeah.
Now, when I want to make recommendations to people, does that mean I just say, just do whatever in the gym, half reps, full reps, exercises, just doesn't matter. Just exactly. Just go into the gym, spend 2 hours, however you want in there, and things will work out for you. The universe has a plan, you know? No, I just say, look, emphasize lower muscle lengths, find exercises that give you a good stretch on the muscle group, ideally with a good amount of difficulty and or tension in that lengthened position, and you're doing your best job, right? And the reason I make these recommendations instead of just taking the sort of nihilist approach of, these effect sizes are small anyways, Very few things matter in the grand scheme of things with lifting weights besides showing up consistently and having most things roughly in place. The reason I'm not taking that nihilist perspective or that sort of meh, it's a small effect size perspective, is because, again, little to no implementation cost of one strategy versus the next. So that's why I recommend that.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So now with everything that we, like the info that you gathered, do you have a preferred way of implementing this? Like, you know, like the reverse drop sets or partials, just altering the technique? Like, how do you like to go about it?
Yeah. So I have a variety of tools, and generally I'll recommend a few specifically. And then if you want to experiment further, you can incorporate a few more tools that I'll talk about at the end. Mm-hmm. The first few tools I would recommend for most people seeking to optimize hypertrophy. So first things first, you can get really good hypertrophy with just a full range of motion or reasonably long range of motion, or even probably not quite as good, but decent hypertrophy from short muscle length partials. But if you want to maximize hypertrophy, or you just want to use the best strategy, given that there's no cost to implementation, here's what I would do. First thing I'd do would be to pause at the fully lengthened position in most exercises where there's at least some tension on that muscle group in that exercise. For example, pausing at the dumbbell at the bottom of a dumbbell lateral raise, probably not super important because there's no tension anyways. However, on exercises like the bench, right, or the squat, where you do get quite a bit of tension on your quads or chest, other way around, respectively, it does make sense to pause there, to spend proportionally more time in the lengthened position in those exercises. Mm-hmm. That's tool number one. Tool number two is potentially incorporating some stretched supersets or reverse drop sets or whatever we want to call them. A lot of cool names, but the idea stays the same pretty much. The idea with a stretched superset is to take a set with full range of motion somewhere close to failure, if not to failure, and then instead of just resting and waiting until your next set, continue the set, but this time only doing the first half or so of the concentric part of the range of motion. So the first half of the concentric, so that's usually like the first half of the lifting phase, mm-hmm. do that portion until, again, you reach a similar proximity to failure, or again, to failure. And that way, even with exercises like dumbbell ladder raises are a great example, where you don't really have a ton of tension in the lengthy position, and so it might not be the best exercise as a whole, by using this technique, you might get more of the benefit of longer muscle lengths, because it essentially allows you to bias the longer muscle lengths, even with an exercise that doesn't usually place much tension or make that part of the range of motion very difficult. So that's tool number two. And I would predominantly use this technique for muscle groups like the side delts, the back, the biceps, maybe the calves and forearms and abs, for example, as well, to a lesser extent. But then for muscle groups like the chest, triceps, quads and hamstrings and glutes, you probably don't need to incorporate it, but I wouldn't say you're losing out on anything if you are incorporating it for that as well.
Cool. Yeah.
That's tool number two. Tool number three is mostly regarding exercise selection. Generally, you'll want to pick exercises that emphasize the lengthened part of the range of motion over ones that emphasize the shortened part of the range of motion. So if you have two options, one exercise like machine row that is quite heavy at the shortened position, but really easy at the length position, or one that's the opposite, pick the second one, because that one will likely give you better hypertrophy. And that applies to both which parts of the range of motion are difficult with certain exercise, and also which range of motion it incorporates. So certain exercises are inherently more shortened. Like, for example, a spider curl has your shoulder flexed, and so has your bicep a bit more shortened than, for example, an incline curl would, right? Yeah. In both exercises, there's not a ton of tension, if any, at the very bottom of the exercise on the bicep, but one exercise does place the biceps in a more lengthened position compared to the other. So in this case, the incline curl would be a better option than the spider curl, all else being equal. And I think generally the split between sort of quote-unquote lengthened emphasis exercises and shortened emphasis exercises, or just general exercises within your program, should be somewhere between sort of 60-40 in favor of lengthened biased exercises to maybe all the way to 80-20 or something, sort of that proportion I'm talking about. I think you can even take it further than this, and here's the additional tools that you could use to do so. The first one would be just shifting the bias from maybe, say, 60-40 to like 90-10 or something, or even 100-0, And that's if you basically buy into the research so far on regional hypertrophy, and that there's essentially no real benefit to regional hypertrophy from short muscle length work, in which case you could technically just get away with avoiding it altogether and just doing low muscle length work, because it affords you more hypertrophy as a whole and provides you with uniform hypertrophy across each muscle group. So you don't need to train a muscle group at short muscle lengths to get good hypertrophy all across that muscle group. That's one option. Another option would be to experiment with a greater amount of stretch supersets. So not just for back, bicep, side delts, and so forth, but also for chest, tricep, quads, etc. Not sure how much you get out of that, but it's worth doing. And then a final thing you could do is experiment with partial range of motion only, or even isometric only exercises and sets at long muscle lengths. So for example, what you could do is grab a cable and just do partials in the lengthen range on side, on lateral raises, right?
Mm-hmm.
So essentially there you're doing a set with only partial range of motion reps in length position. Or you could do a wall sit where you're sitting in the ass to grass position and just getting a lot of tension for like 30, 60 seconds, what have you, at long muscle lengths. So those are the three tools that I would potentially incorporate if you're willing to experiment a bit further and, you know, you trust the research quite a bit as it stands.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was, I'm going to clip this and I'm going to sell this as like a mini DVD or something.
Do it. Let's make some money.
So because like this is a beautiful wrap up, I don't really want to go into this deeply, but like, am I correct that like what you mentioned at the end, so basically that would be like an isometric contraction, right?
Yep.
That it's, interestingly, we just don't know that much about that. So like everybody assumes that we know that dynamic contractions are much better than isometrics, but we don't actually. It's just an assumption. Is that more or less
100%, 100%. There's not a lot of direct evidence on, for example, eccentric only versus concentric only versus isometric only, or concentric plus eccentric, so dynamic contractions versus isometric for hypertrophy. And there's never been a systematic review or meta-analysis on this topic. And so that's something actually that we want to do, in part because everyone, as you mentioned, always has that idea in the back of their heads of, hey, isometrics are bad for hypertrophy. We definitely need to take an exercise through a concentric and eccentric phase to maximize hypertrophy. But I'm not sure that's true. You know, as appealing as it is, you know, oh, if you just train one muscle length, there's all these issues. As appealing as that is, I'm not sure it's true. And so I'd love to have a review and a meta-analysis. And that's something we're working on, in quotation marks, because it's going to take a while to get there with me balancing PhD training, coaching, super secret thad work thing. So it's going to take a while, but we'll get there. And I think once we have that evidence, it'll help inform a lot of training decisions. Because I think so far people have, broadly speaking, stayed away from isometric training because of the sort of meme. And I don't mean meme in the funny way. I mean meme in the sense that it's at the back of everyone's heads.
Yeah.
That isometrics are worse, but if they aren't, that could open up the door for a lot of other exercises we haven't considered, like bed hangs, for example, for lat hypertrophy, or wall sits for quad hypertrophy, and so forth.
It's super awesome that you're doing all of this this work. Like, and yeah, a client of mine just sent me a voice note the other day saying like, yeah, I listened to this interview with Milo on Dave's channel. Like, yeah, like this guy's definitely going to blow up very soon. Like, I'm very excited about everything that you're going to do. I'm like, damn, so, I am too. I just thought I would let you know, like you're having more and more followers even without you knowing it. So
I appreciate that, man. I'm glad I'm able to add to a body of evidence that I care about, because I started lifting 8 years ago. I like lifting weights. I like helping other people lift weights. And B, just it's fun in itself, you know, like it's fun talking about the research, it's fun doing the research. I'm glad I got into this industry and I'm happy to be able to help people with it.
Yeah. No, it's awesomeness. Milo, so yeah, we basically got to write about an hour. So I think we can wrap up here. So I'm really grateful for everything that you shared here. And please just let people know where they can find you, everything that you'd like to plug, mention.
Sure. My favorite part of every podcast is where I get to advertise myself. Very cool.
You learned it from Mike Israetel, I'm sure.
Like, indeed.
Those folks.
Indeed. You can find me on Instagram at WolfCoach. So that's my last name, Wolf and Coach. You can find my website at wolfcoaching.net for coaching stuff and related stuff. Or you can apply for coaching with Strong by Science, who I'm currently also coaching for. At strongbyscience.com/coaching. Finally, I have a podcast as well called Muscle and Feels. So if you search on YouTube, Muscle and Feels, or go into my Instagram account and look at the bios link, you'll find that as well. And finally, if you're more interested in research-related stuff, you can find my profile on ResearchGate. So ResearchGate, Milo Wolf, and you can find the preprint there. You can find previous projects, like, for example, looking at how accurate people are at gauging reps in reserve, and some other cool projects that I've helped out on. And you can find all of that on ResearchGate on my profile, Milo Wolf.
Awesome. Milo, thanks a lot for being on. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Awesome. I'll stop this.